Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me today is Tish Buckner. Tish,
hi.
How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Yeah, Jasmine is sick today, so Tish is filling in for her. She is in the Emerge class of 2019, former AmeriCorps Vista, and going to talk to us today about a bunch of different stuff. So we're glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we have several stories we're going to talk about, but we do have a representative, Sherilyn Stevenson, on the show today. You guys hopefully have heard from Sherilyn before on the show. She's a representative in the 88th District out in Lexington. It was a really nice conversation about her first legislative session, about her election that she won by 48 votes. It was really good. I hope you guys are ready for a great conversation. For that, we definitely have lots of news to get to. We have a couple of decisions at the Sixth Circuit of Appeals Courts that Tish is going to talk to us about. We have some other stuff about Adam Edelin and some and marijuana, which is always fun, and a special session, which is on the horizon. Well, without any further ado, let's get started. Tish, tell us what we need to know about transfer agreements.
All right, cool. So federal judge Greg Stiver struck down a law that required Kentucky's abortion providers to have transfer agreements in place with hospitals in order to operate. We brought this up recently because Planned Parenthood is asking to hold the Bevin administration in contempt for not granting them a license. And this was a law that kept them from getting one, but it was struck down.
Right.
This means clinics had to have contracts with hospitals for ambulance services for emergencies. The transfer agreement law has been on the books since 1998, but the Bevin administration imposed stricter regulations on the transfer agreements. Judge Stivers found that the law posed an undue burden on women seeking abortions.
Right, and that undue burdens is like a really important thing that was in Roe v. Wade, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
And so this was the U.S. District Court, Bevin appealed to the Sixth Circuit, and that's where we are now.
Right.
The ACLU maintains that the transfer agreement law is unconstitutional.
Right, right.
But Attorney General Andy Beshear has filed a brief in the case arguing that strict regulations for transfer agreements are unconstitutional, but that the transfer agreement law itself is not.
Right. So that's kind of an interesting needle to thread, right? To say well, the law itself is not unconstitutional, but like being too strict about it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. People have been talking back and forth about Andy Beshear and abortion a lot recently.
Yes.
Yeah. Because like Adam Edelin came out really strong to say he's like, I'm pro-choice. Yeah. And people are like, what does Andy Beshear think? And here I can kind of think it leans into the narrative a little bit like, oh, you know, I'm pro-choice, but only most of the time. Yeah.
He doesn't want to really announce and come out.
Not like leaning too hard into it. Right. Right. Yeah.
So Beshear filed an amicus brief, meaning that he is not a party to the lawsuit, but may have an interest in the outcome or expertise or help to provide to the judges in deciding how to rule.
Right.
The ACLU says the EMW will always be endangered if the law is upheld, because this is what the Bevin administration has been refusing give out licenses.
Right. Yeah. So basically they're saying, you know, he's basically trying to strike down abortion by making this law too strictly enforced.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's definitely what's going on, right? Because, you know, I think there was at least one other clinic that was supposed to open in Louisville and one that was supposed to open in Lexington. And both of them have had trouble getting off the ground.
Because of the transfer agreement and licenses.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of the whole deal there. Yeah. So it's pretty wild. Very interesting. Andy Beshear filing that amicus brief. We also got a ruling that the federal judge struck it down. So we'll see if it ends up in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So we'll see. All right. So that wasn't it for abortion in the Sixth Circuit. Tell us about the ultrasound bill.
All right. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the lower court's ruling that the ultrasound law was unconstitutional and upheld the law. The ultrasound law was passed in 2017 and required doctors to perform an ultrasound, describe the images, and play audio of a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Dave Hale held that the law was unconstitutional. It was a violation of the First Amendment right to free speech.
Mm-hmm.
He said that there was evidence that the national standard was to offer women the opportunity to see the ultrasound, and there was no evidence that women were being denied this information.
Mm-hmm.
They upheld the law by a 2-1 vote, with Judge John Bush writing the majority. Bush was also a Trump appointee from Louisville.
Right, right, yeah.
So there you go.
real proud of that guy, yeah.
And the other judge voting with Bush is Alan Norris, and he was a Reagan appointee.
Right. Not too surprising. The two Republican-appointed judges upheld the abortion law.
Mm-hmm. And then holding stated, we hold that HB2 provides relevant information. The information conveyed by an ultrasound image, its description, and the audible beating fetal heart gives the patient a greater knowledge of the unborn life inside her. This also inherently provides the patient a greater knowledge about the effect of an abortion procedure. It shows her of what or whom she is consenting to terminate.
Mm-hmm.
Because the law provides truthful, non-misleading information that is relevant, the speech is not afforded a higher level of scrutiny, so no First Amendment violation.
Right. So it's kind of, you know, okay, so people know my story hopefully by now a little bit about my wife having to have an abortion at 20 weeks for our child. Yeah. Well, I can just tell you that this like whole process is just really stupid.
It is.
It's like they sit there and they do an ultrasound and they are like, okay, so that's your ultrasound. Here's the heartbeat. And this basically like just the people who are doing the ultrasound are typically like they're employees at the clinic. So,
right.
You know, they're not going to, you know, try to talk you out of having an abortion because they work at the clinic. Like that's the clinic they work at. So it's just kind of weird, the whole process.
Yeah. I agree.
A lot of butting in to people's lives.
And personal business.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
And these are supposed to be people of the First Amendment.
Right, so exactly.
Celebrate the First Amendment.
They're judges, freedom, right? Yeah. They're supposed to care about the Constitution. Yeah.
Yes. So the dissenter was Judge Bernice Bayou McDonald, an Obama appointee from Tennessee. She agreed that it was a violation of freedom of speech and that the law has no medical basis.
Right. Okay. Well, Tish, as people can probably figure out, like these are Jasmine's notes about abortion, but you have some stuff about this topic that you wanted to talk about a little bit. So tell us what we wanted to tell us what we need to know.
Just some recent remarks with our past legislative session. There were remarks about black women and comparison of abortion to lynching.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to clarify some of the ramifications of the misinformation that people are anti-abortion opponents say when they speak in this language. But black women in slavery used abortion as a way to resist against the structural and systematic violence and oppression that they were in with slavery, and also infanticide, so killing their own children. Angela Davis actually talks about in her book, Women, Race, and Class, that women in slavery resisted and advocated challenges to slavery at every turn. So they did everything they needed to do to protect them, their bodies, because they were literally breeding. Like their slaveholders found that their profit was them having children and the reproduction of the slave, a black woman.
There's that. And then also in addition to that, like the systematic rape female slaves by white masters. Yeah.
Yes. And then not only that, that they would have children of mixed race and they would get, the children would be mistreated or abused and they would get, you know, because they'd had this child with the slaveholder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a lot. So when people compare it to, you know, lynching is a form of terrorism, you know, that was used at the end of slavery and all through Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say that, it's kind of like, you know, this was a scare tactic to scare black people and not to go against the oppressive system.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. You kind of tell me what you think about this. But one of the things that I found so striking in those comparisons, right, is you have like a lot of white Republicans out there that are trying to like, almost like they're trying to like call to like black people to say, oh, you should be on our side because this is like this, when that just totally misunderstands the history of you know, how women's bodies were abused and what ways, like you just mentioned, abortion was sometimes used as a way to like fight back against slavery.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And you know, just having been through this process, I can just tell you, like, most people there are doing what they think is the right decision for everybody.
Right.
Not just them, but like their society, their families, and a lot of times, you know, the unborn child too. Reducing it to like to say it's like a selfish decision is just such a terrible thing, you know, I think. Yeah. And there's so much more history. Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. So read Angela Davis.
Angela Davis.
Yeah.
The book is called Women, Race, and Class. So that's the book.
Back in 1981. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, these are ideas that were, I mean, radical at the time, probably still a little radical.
Yes.
But, you know, she's been ahead of her time in so many ways. So, absolutely.
Also with lynching and being an act of terrorism. So the Equal Justice Equal Justice Initiative is a program committed to ending mass incarceration and excessive punishment in the United States and challenging racial and economic justice. And I'm just going to read a quote that they have on their website about lynching. And it says, the convict leasing and sharecropping systems were used to restore white economic dominance and discriminatory laws that deprive black people of political rights. Violent intimidation was the method of enforcement. Mm-hmm. Lynching emerged as a vicious tool of racial control in the South after the Civil War and during Reconstruction as a way to reestablish white supremacy and suppress black civil rights. At the end of the 19th century, Southern lynch mobs targeted and terrorized African Americans with impunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's what that is. You know.
Yeah, so that's that.
Yeah, it's not like going to the abortion clinic.
No,
yeah,
it's
just a whole different thing.
And someone's, you know, having their saying what they want to do with their body, mm-hmm. having that choice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So. Yeah, well, thank you for that. Yeah, I'm really glad to have that shared. Those are some really great resources, the Equal Justice Initiative. Go read Angela Davis's book, Women, Race, and Class.
Yes.
All right, we'll do it. All right.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about some other news. Adam Edelin this week made some big news. He sat down with a Herald Leader reporter, Daniel DeRochers, and said that he was in favor of the decriminalization of marijuana. To be clear, he was very explicit in saying that his campaign did not favor full legalization. So it's not like you can, you know, just use marijuana without getting in trouble. But instead, it would be a reduction in penalties for possession of marijuana to something closer to like a traffic ticket. You don't get thrown in jail for speeding on the interstate. You know, you get a ticket. It would be about the same level of problems. DeRochers reported that his plan called for fines of about $100 for possession of less than a half ounce of marijuana. Yeah. So Edelin cited the costs for prosecution. He said it was, I didn't fact check this, but Edelin said it was $50 million to maintain incarceration for people for marijuana issues. And he said that was a major reason for his support of reform. He said, you know, we're trying to do all this huge stuff. We're trying to make big investments in the state. We can't do that if we're going to spend $50 million incarcerating people for possession of less than a half ounce of marijuana. He also called it the moral thing to do in addition to the financially responsible thing to do. Yeah. Edelin also did not close the door for eventual legalization of recreational use of marijuana. He said that his plan was to be strategic and to allow communities to determine their own approach for how to deal with marijuana. And to me, what I heard there was, if Louisville wants to legalize marijuana in Louisville, we're going to let them do that. And if, you know, Barron County wants to keep it so that they have to issue a ticket, like, they can do that. So he's open to like Louisville having mm-hmm. its own ability to set mm-hmm. laws there. That's kind of what I read into that there.
Yeah.
He also said that his plan would be incremental and it wouldn't necessarily stop with decriminalization, that it would just kind of start there. DeRochers also asked the other two gubernatorial candidates about marijuana. Both Andy Beshear and Rocky Adkins said that they were open to the idea of decriminalization. So, you know, even if Adam Edelin doesn't win, here's hoping that just by putting that issue on the table, you know, Adam Edelin has successfully made this a priority for whoever comes out of the Democratic primary. Because this is a big issue.
It is.
Yeah, especially in, everywhere. Yeah.
Right.
And also just like in perhaps related news, I don't know if this could be related, the Kentucky Young Democrats, they held their annual convention last weekend and they took a straw poll. Mm-hmm. Adam Edelin came out with a majority of support among the three candidates. He got 56% of the support, and Rocky Adkins was in second with 35% and Andy Beshear was in third with 9%. So very interesting information there. Mm-hmm. Straw polls obviously don't amount to much, but it was kind of an interesting thing about what young Democratic activists think about this race.
Mm.
I mean, what do you think about all this? What do you think about the candidates and their reactions to marijuana decriminalization? Are you glad that Adam Edelin put it on the table?
Yeah, I'm glad he put that on the forefront. I just think with what, you know, what's going on in our country with this whole legalization of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I hope that the whole decriminalization of marijuana mm-hmm. for those who are incarcerated because of, you know, having less than an ounce happens as well, and mm-hmm. they get some type of reparation or some type of funding.
Yeah, or at least some sort of expungement.
Yeah, expungement. You know, for the charge that they got.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward towards that type of policy for people.
Absolutely. So, not just that, like an easy expungement.
An easy expungement.
Because that's another big issue with this issue. California has a deal where, you know, they made it legal. They said, you know, we're legalizing recreational use. But in order to get this expunged from your record, you have to, like, you know, you have to do some work.
Yeah.
And there's been some really interesting efforts by, you know, the Code for America is a group that's involved in this to make it so that large number of people can get their records expunged. But it's still a lot of effort.
So
if we ever go that direction, I do hope that we make it easy.
Yes.
Yeah. That's something that's important. All right. So we are likely going to have a special session coming up soon. More legislation. Who's excited? Okay. So on not excited?
No.
Yeah. Okay. So on Tuesday, April 9th, a day before we're recording this, Governor Bevin announced that he was going to veto HB 358. HB 358 is, of course, the pension bill addressing the quasi-governmental agencies. Jasmine told us about that bill last week. So as a reminder about what this is, quasi-governmental agencies are in pretty big danger of bankruptcy without some relief from the increasing pension liabilities that happen from the recalculation of what these governments owed, or what these groups owed to the pension system. So the legislature, they passed a bill at the last moment through a free conference committee in the last hour of the session. So this had basically been something they wanted to address from the very beginning. Both houses passed different bills. They went to a free conference committee. And in a free conference committee, you don't even have to just consider the legislation that's been passed. You can put anything into the bill.
Anything.
Yeah. They came out with a bill an hour before the legislature was adjourned forever for the whole year. And then they all just voted on it. Nobody knew it was in it. Nobody had any idea what was going on in there, but they passed it anyway. So Governor Bevin then vetoed it, and in his veto message, Governor Bevin said that HB 358, quote, would have added too much to the strain of the state's public pension shortfall, unquote. He was also frustrated with the timeline of the payback period. Under the bill, groups would basically have been allowed 30 years to pay back what they owed. Yeah, so the structure is, you know, you have to pay back what you owe eventually, even if you're switching to a different pension plan, and you would have up to 30 years. And Governor Bevin said that's too long. They need to pay it faster than that. So the governor's veto definitely caught legislative leaders off guard. So Chris McDaniel is the Senate budget chair, and he said he was, quote, absolutely stunned. And Jerry Miller, the House budget chair, said that he was, quote, quite surprised. So it looked like that there wasn't much communication between the governor's office and the legislative leaders about this veto. And during the original veto period, that period of time after the legislature let out to let Governor Bevin either sign or veto bills, it seemed like nearly everybody was frustrated by this bill. And I think that the way that the legislature treated this issue was not very good. And honestly, in my opinion, I think it's actually probably good that Governor Bevin vetoed this bill. It was a bad bill.
It was a bad bill.
And I'm not a Governor Bevin fan by any stretch of the imagination.
Me either.
But you know, this was the right thing to do here. But as we learned last year, there was supposed to be a special session, but these are kind of a big gamble.
Yeah.
Like, you remember the one last year?
Last year,
it was only supposed to, they were like, we're going to get this through in 1 week, and they adjourned without doing anything.
Yeah.
It was pretty stupid. Yeah, so we'll see what's actually going to happen. Both the chamber's leaders were very frustrated by this. So Speaker Osborne, he doesn't seem to have faith in the governor's ability to effectively execute a special session. And why should he, right? In a statement, he said, quote, I am hopeful that the governor will begin meeting with us immediately to find a solution. It is critical that we do this before calling a special session without a solution in hand, unquote. So it seems like he's like, you need to talk to us about what you want, which may have been the problem in the first place. Senate President Stivers also was pretty annoyed. He called the veto, quote, perplexing. So we have one that says, what, absolutely stunned. Quite surprising, and now perplexing. Senate President Stivers said, quote, before the Senate is called into an extraordinary session, the governor should set the parameters for what he is willing to sign. We need a bill to address this problem, which is actuarially sound, is able to pass both chambers, and can withstand political and legal scrutiny, unquote. Yeah, so it's kind of a mess.
Yeah, it's always a mess.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it seems, this is a thing that Jasmine and I talk a lot about, but it just seems like they're just so bad at stakeholder management.
Exactly.
Like, they need to learn what can be tolerated between, like, the House and the Senate. Yeah.
What's going to go through.
What's going to go through. What the governor's okay to sign. Yeah, it seems like that the House and the Senate, they didn't, you know, check with the governor before passing the bill.
Right.
Well, they actually contest that. They said they did try to check with him, and he said he would sign it, but he didn't. So one of them is not telling the truth. Yeah. And then the governor doesn't seem like he has done well to communicate what he wants either, right, with these legislative leaders. So it's just a big mess. Like, and you know, it doesn't seem like it should be hard to do. They need to all get in a room, hammer out what they want to do. We're not going to like it. You know, they're going to put something that's probably considerably more conservative, mm-hmm, than we would prefer. But they all just need to hammer it out and then have the session. At least if it's going to be a bad bill, have it be passed in a good process. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would prefer it not to be passed at all. But it's just kind of ridiculous that we're going to have to pay, you know, $68,000
for a special session.
For every day of the special session. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's that. Kind of a mess. All right. Before we get to the interview with Sherrilyn Stevenson, let's talk through a couple of other issues. So Louisville's having a massive budget problem, Tish. You probably have heard about this. Yeah, big mess.
Big mess.
And we did say a couple of weeks ago that the Belle of Louisville was going to be docked, mm-hmm, as part of the budget problems in Louisville. I don't know. Maybe no boat race. Very sad. No boat race.
Right.
But it does look like Louisville Tourism is going to step in and the Belle is going to remain on the river.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
So if that's something you wanted to see, you see that red paddle going through the Ohio River, you're going to keep seeing it. So, all right. So another thing, this is a little bit more serious. Kentucky's fired the infectious disease chief. Kentucky has, I didn't know this number. Kentucky has seen 4,419 cases of hepatitis A.
Yes.
And 52 deaths from the disease. Mm-hmm. This is an epidemic that started in November of 2017. So that guy's not been doing a very good job, if that's the case. But, you know, I don't really know the full story there. I kind of want to do some more research into this. But, yeah, hopefully the person that get in there after that will be able to get a handle on this, because it seems like we're having a worse time than just about anywhere else.
Yes.
There was some good reporting in the Courier-Journal from about a couple months ago about this, focusing on kind of the victims, but how the situation all happened is going to be a story I need to look into at least. Okay, a couple more education system or stories. So the Bevin administration, so specifically the Division of Labor, has subpoenaed the records of JCPS teachers who participated in sick outs during the legislative session. Not a nice move on their part. This is different than a similar action that was taken by the Kentucky Board of Education.
Yeah,
Wayne Lewis did this. He like got the records, asked JCPS for the records, and they gave them to him. But now the Department of Labor is asking for those same records, and they gave them to them. So the subpoenas that the Department of Labor issued, they instructed the districts, JCPS and the other districts, not to tell the teachers that their names have been released, saying that would interfere with, quote, an ongoing investigation.
Why would they not tell the teachers that they're being investigated?
It seems like they just kind of want to show up one day and be like, you owe us $1,000 or something. So,
wow, that's shady.
Yeah, it's really shady. I mean,
honestly,
it is like, you know, by the letter of the law, you know, well, I'm not a lawyer. I shouldn't say that. But there are some provisions against like striking and work stoppages on an organized basis. And, you know, I think that the Republicans are pretty upset that, you know, these teachers like got to Frankfurt to fight them on this sort of stuff. And this just seems like an intimidation tactic. Like,
it is.
Yeah. Maybe they won't do anything, but they're trying to scare people into not showing up next year in Frankfurt.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Teachers,
I wonder.
I was going to show up.
Yeah. I think that's probably right. But they, you know, they're going to at least give them a little bit of a scare. That's what they're trying to do. So. All right, so the Courier-Journal also reports that the Kentucky Board of Education believes that two principals inside of JCPS at Shelby and Johnstown Road, which I believe are elementary schools.
Elementary schools, mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah. The Kentucky Board of Education does not believe that the principals at those schools are going to be able to do their jobs effectively. So you may have remember the takeover, the State Board of Education tried to do a takeover, but they decided not to. Yeah, and since they decided not to take over JCPS, they actually can't fire those people.
Exactly.
But they have kind of told JCPS, like, hey, these guys aren't good at their jobs, and we'll see what JCPS does. They haven't said what actions they're going to take. So that also is a little, like, intimidation. You know?
We're watching you, big brother.
Yeah, these guys can't do their jobs. You better fire them, or else we're going to come and take you over. You know, that's the kind of, they've been hanging that over the heads of JCPS.
Yeah. There's something against JCPS that.
Yeah. We're both. Yeah. Jasmine did not graduate from JCPS, but me and you, we're both JCPS grads.
And my mom's a JCPS teacher.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
Shout out to JCPS teachers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And lastly, and this is, oh my gosh, I just saw this earlier today. It is this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. So Congressman Thomas Massie, a Kentucky United States Congressperson, He is a member of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. Yes. He got the chance to question former Secretary of State John Kerry yesterday, April 9th.
Yes.
He took that time to question whether John Kerry's degree in political science was truly a science degree, which that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. John Kerry's response was, "Are you serious?" The full questioning is truly, truly one of the stupidest things I've ever seen.
I mean, are we surprised?
Yeah, no.
By his remarks.
No, like, I don't think anybody would think like, I don't think even, no political scientist is like, my discipline is similar to biology or something.
Right.
You know?
Like, you know, because he went to MIT. So it's like, what if we disregarded your degree in engineering? Why aren't you an engineer? Why are you in politics?
Yeah, there you go.
Why not be an engineer since you know so much about science?
Yeah, you know.
Quote unquote.
Yeah. What do you know about technology? You're an engineer.
Right.
Yeah, right. You know,
to MIT, like.
That's an institute of technology, not an institute of engineering. You know, right. Oh, my goodness. He's such a, I mean, I will say that, like, there is a strain of folks, and this is in both parts of the Democratic Party and parts of the Republican Party, that are more driven by trolling people than by doing
stuff.
And he's
definitely
He is that guy. He had on his Twitter yesterday, he had a hashtag that was called
Sassy by Massey.
Yeah, Sassy with Massey.
Whatever it was.
Oh, that's not funny, guy. It's not.
No, he just needs to stop.
Yeah, all right. All right, well, Tish, thank you so much for coming in and talking
to us.
Thank
you, Robert, for having me.
Yeah, and thank you again for your education a little bit earlier about some of the resources about abortion and its connection to race and the stuff of the Equal Justice Initiative. Very interesting stuff. Thank you for talking to us about it.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. And now let's listen to my interview with Sherilyn Stevenson. Sherilyn Stevenson is a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives from District 88 in Southeast Fayette County. After decisively winning a three-way Democratic primary, Representative Stevenson won the general election by 48 votes, 0.2% of the total votes cast. Representative Stevenson was one of the first guests we ever had on My Old Kentucky podcast, and we asked her to come back onto the show to discuss her election and the recent legislative session. Sherilyn Stevenson, welcome back to My Old Kentucky podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. So the last time you were here, you were just a candidate in a Democratic primary for the seat that you currently hold. So let's just start a little bit by talking about like the general election. You know, you won by a really slim margin. Tell us what it was like on election night for you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I like to joke and say I won by 48 votes, and there was one for every heart attack that I had that night. It was really a different vibe. The primary election was the very first election I had ever run in, and we got really lucky from the very first time that they started reporting the precincts. We were ahead, and we led the entire time. So it was a really surreal experience, but then when it came to the general and it was so close, it was so nerve-wracking.
I can't even imagine. It would be crazy.
It was really crazy, and you know, and you're standing there, and so it was kind of back and forth. In the very beginning, he was ahead, and it just, like, I think the weight of everything, we had just been working so hard. I mean, we just had our eye on the prize, and my team and I were just going absolutely nonstop. And so to finally stop and know, you know, there's nothing else that you can do, the polls are about to close, and it was just really hard to look around that room at the volunteers, at my friends and family who had worked so hard. So many of them, I mean, just practically put their lives on hold to help me and to help themselves get a representative that truly represented them. And that was a lot of pressure, knowing that if I didn't pull that off for them, you know, that they had done that for nothing. And it was just really hard, and it really settled on me very heavily that I had asked so much of these people, and they had given so much to me, and the possibility was that we were absolutely going to lose. I was really, really thankful. We actually had some people at 7 o'clock. We heard that there were still people waiting in line to vote, so we knew that the results were going to come in late, and so it was kind of late when we got the final word. So it was a long night.
Yeah, campaigns end up being a little bit like families, and I can imagine sitting there when it's that close and having it come down to something like that. Well, speaking about your election a little bit, several observers, you know, after all the dust had settled kind of on that election night, they pointed to Lieutenant Colonel Amy McGrath, who ran in the 6th Congressional District that's partially there in Lexington. And she had a really good race in Fayette County. And a lot of people point to her as, you know, providing a lot of coattails to a lot of candidates. And some people have even gone on to say, you know, without her on the ballot, you and other candidates wouldn't have fared as well. Do you think that's accurate, and does that worry you going forward?
You know, it's really hard to say. There's no real way for us to measure that. She was absolutely a dynamic woman and a dynamic candidate, and she excited a lot of people to get involved in ways that they never had before. But we have 54 precincts in the 88, and I actually received more votes than she did in a quarter of those.
Wow.
So, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's really hard to tell. We did coordinate with her campaign to do Get Out the Vote, and we loved that, and they were so gracious and generous to us in doing that. So who's to say?
Right. Well, I mean, who knows? She may be on the ballot again in 2020, so there's no way to know for sure.
She very well could be.
Right, yeah, absolutely. and so by no means, you know, is your seat really a safe one? You know, that we had Atticus Scott and Charles Booker on the show in the last 2 weeks, and their seats, you know, while they provide very strong leadership, they're pretty safe when it comes to re-election. Your re-election for you is going to be really tough, and it's going to require a lot of effort. So what are you doing right now to think about what you're going to need to do in order to keep the 88th in your hands, in Democratic hands, in 2020?
Well, you know, I would be really disingenuous if I said I hadn't thought about it, because we do have to run every 2 years, and that 48 vote margin, you know, is slim, and we know it's a tough district, and until this year it had always been a red district, and we definitely do want to keep that blue. But right now I am very much just trying to focus on being the best representative for the people in the 88th district that I can be. I'm trying to stay out in the community and be very visible to them, be very accessible to them. I'm trying to be very responsive to them during the session. I had people that commented when I returned their phone call or their email, or I sent them a postcard because they had called me, that it was the first time they'd ever had a representative that did that. You know, I feel like we're already kind of heading in a good direction. And again, I'm just trying to be really responsive and be the best that I can be for them. And all of a sudden now we've got special session looming over us. So,
right.
You know, so I'm just trying to take it one day at a time right now. And as I just got out of my very first session, really try to just focus on the district and focus on the people and see what I can do to help.
Right. What's the point of running if you're not actually going to do the job, right?
And a lot of people don't realize that the majority of this job happens in your district. It doesn't all happen in Frankfort. You know, we go to Frankfort for a very short period of time during the year. And the rest of the time, I and my office can be a valuable resource to these people, and we offer constituent services. There's just a lot of things that we can do, and I want to do that for those people. Yeah. I want them to be someone that they think of, you know, immediately when they have problems that need to be solved.
Yeah, that'll definitely pay dividends when it comes time for re-election. So during this legislative session, you know, you were the chief sponsor of four pieces of legislation. HB 424 and 425 were both health care bills that focus on chronic pain. So tell us a little bit about this issue and why it's important to you.
So 424 and 425, which moving forward I will probably file as one bill, mm-hmm. because they're really companion pieces, and they got sent to two separate committees, which obviously the committees didn't hear them, so it didn't matter. But moving forward, I will put them together. But 424 actually said that insurance, private and public things like Medicaid, it required the insurances to start covering complementary services like acupuncture, massage therapy, chiropractic services, things like that. So there are certain insurances out there that do not do that at the moment, and so it required them to start doing so. And then 425, it did not require physicians to use those things, but it highly encouraged them to utilize those services before they would write a brand new opioid prescription. So this was really, you know, an effort to curb the number of opioid prescriptions that are happening for chronic pain. A mm-hmm. physician actually brought this idea to me and we started doing a little bit of research, and it actually came to our attention that several states surrounding Kentucky have started working on this, and West Virginia and Tennessee in particular, and Blue Cross Blue Shield in Tennessee now will not cover opioids. So, you know, there are several states around us that are you know, trying to get really proactive in their fight against the opioid crisis, and so I wanted to offer something that I thought was a real solution.
Excellent. You offered to sponsor it after a doctor talked to you about it. So maybe tell us a little bit about that process, like people bringing you ideas and then how they turn into bills.
Yeah, so I think that probably happens more than people realize. Constituents and people just from the community approach legislators and say, hey, do you realize that this is happening? And when you start to talk to them more about that and you start to research it yourself, you're like, oh, well, let's do something about that. So we have a wonderful set of bill writers and researchers at the LRC. So you can just send them a quick email and say, hey, can you pull research for me on XYZ? And they'll do that. And then, you know, you can work back and forth with them to craft that legislation the way that that you want to. And if you want to pull other people in, like the doctor or whatever, you can kind of collaborate on that issue. And so I think a lot of bills actually come about in that manner, and a lot of people don't know that.
Sure. So you also sponsored a bill that would require teachers to have more time in their day for self-directed activities. How did that one come about?
Right. Well, that, again, came about with a lot of teachers approaching me. So my mom's a teacher. My campaign team was made up of a lot of teachers. And one thing I think, if you ask a teacher what they desperately need more time of, or what they desperately need, they'll tell you that they need more time.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill actually just stated that they would get 120 minutes of self-directed planning time each week. So a lot of teachers end up saying that, yes, they have these planning periods every day, but they get eaten up with meetings that their school administrators or whatever they schedule, and then their actual planning time then has to happen on their own time. And
right.
So we all know that teachers work overtime in various tremendous ways, weekends, evenings, during the summer. So that is just a way to try to protect a little bit of their time during the week.
Yeah. It sounds like you're trying to be as responsive as possible. People are bringing you ideas, and you're trying to put those into legislation as people bring them to you.
Well, yeah. I mean, isn't that what we're there to do?
Yeah. That's certainly one way to go about doing it. Yeah.
The people?
Yeah, absolutely. And the last bill you sponsored was kind of funny. It was HB 427 that would have switched coal to be the official rock of Kentucky and agate made the official mineral. And in the media, some people were kind of making fun of this a little bit, saying, you know, don't we have time? You know, we only have 30 legislative days. Why are we messing with this? Why did you decide to sponsor this bill?
You know, sometimes, a lot of times, bills get filed just to start conversations.
Mm-hmm.
You know that they may not go anywhere this particular session, but it's something that you can work on, start to try to build a little bit of public support or public just acknowledgement that there is an issue. And so when this bill was brought forward to me as well by Dr. Trent Garrison, who is at Northern Kentucky University, and my question was, why would we not correct this mistake? Like, as someone who is a strong supporter of education and someone who believes in science, why would we not correct this mistake? And he had the full support of Kentucky scientific community behind him, the American Institute of Professional Geologists, Kentucky section, and the Kentucky Academy of Science were all behind this, and actually our state geologist was on board with this as well. So the scientific community wanted it. Again, it's a huge mistake, so probably not correct it.
Sure.
And it could be fixed so easily. Like, if you look at the bill, it was like four lines.
Right.
It took the bill writer like 60 seconds to write this bill.
Yeah.
We sit in our committee meetings all the time. So many things get passed really quickly. I was in a committee meeting this year that was 10 minutes, and we passed three bills.
Wow.
So, you know, in 5 minutes, it could pass in the House. It would get put on the consent calendar. In 5 minutes, it would pass the Senate committee and get put on their consent calendar. The governor was on it. we can fix this problem in like 12 minutes.
Yeah, no doubt. We're talking about having a single day legislative session for this for the upcoming special session. Yeah, there's no reason that we would need to take too much time to fix something that's factually incorrect in our laws. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. So, as with almost all the Democratic members, none of your bills even received a vote in committee. Did you expect this going in, and how are you thinking about moving some of this legislation that you're clearly very passionate about through in future sessions?
I didn't expect that hardly any Democratic bills would get through. I knew as a freshman legislator coming in that I probably wouldn't get any traction whatsoever. So that didn't surprise me, but the overall part did surprise me a little bit. And I think that really what I learned this year in my first session is obviously relationships matter, a lot of the new people that came in, I know as we all talked, we wanted to come in and work in a bipartisan manner. So a lot of the new blood really wanted to come in, help each other out, try to support one another. And so I think moving forward, it's just about working those relationships, but I think it's also just trying to get more public support. I probably wasn't nearly public enough and trying to create enough noise with the public about my bills as I should have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, good luck. I mean, a lot of times things do take multiple sessions, so, you know, no shame in that. And, you know,
yeah.
Hopefully you've got several sessions ahead of you to work on some of this stuff.
Well, hopefully we do. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
So while you were the chief sponsor of these four bills we just talked about, you also added your name as a sponsor to 39 total bills. So the chief sponsors on the bills that you added your names to are actually a very diverse group. So you co-sponsored four of Attica Scott's bills, but also two of Representative Danny Bentley's bills. So besides your own bills, there were 23 Democratic bills and 12 Republican bills that you sponsored. So tell us a little bit about how you decided which bills to add your name to and how you're using the bill sponsorship process to build those relationships with other legislators.
Well, you know, I did not go in looking for bills to co-sponsor by original sponsor. I really went in looking at those topics and what the bill said and what it did, and was it a really good idea that would be beneficial to Kentuckians? And so I'm proud that four of those that I co-sponsored did pass.
Mm-hmm.
Things like House Bill 64, which is says that a pharmacy can refill a prescription in an emergency situation, should that need be. Charles Booker, one of my new colleagues, is a type 1 diabetic, and so that was mm-hmm. something that he really wanted to get behind. And it just makes sense for Kentuckians. So there were a lot of things like that, but that's how I decided. I just went after it. And it is really nice when you're a new, brand-new legislator to, you know, to go up to somebody and introduce yourself and say, hey, I'm Cheryl Lynn, I'm from Lexington, this is a really great idea, I would love to sign on. So it was a really good way to meet people for the first time and try to build goodwill for the first time around that. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if it's a really good idea, I don't care if it came from a Democrat or a Republican.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a good way to do legislation, and glad that there's legislators like you out there in Frankfort. So we talked a little bit at the beginning of the show about how your district is one of the most closely contested in the entire legislature. And in addition to that, you know, you voted against all of the major abortion legislation that passed in the last week of the legislative session. That's HB 5, HB 148, SB 9, and SB 50. And one thing that, you know, you hear often is, you know, there's a lot of Democrats out there who oppose these bills but vote for them just to protect their seat. So tell us why you decided to take a stand on your principles and vote against these bills.
You know, I am very happy to tell you that those votes were really constituent-led. When I campaigned and we talked to people on both sides of the aisle, you know, this issue did not come up for us very much in the 88th District, and I'll be the first to say I was a little bit surprised by that. I think I got the question one time, my dad got it one time, I think somebody else maybe got it one time, but we're talking like a teeny tiny handful. We knocked on 18,000 doors.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this enough times to just count on one hand, which was kind of great. So it let me know that this is just really not a prominent issue in our district. And so I was very anxious to see what the feedback would be like with phone calls and emails that started coming in as those things were introduced. And, you know, while there were a fair amount of people that were asking me to support those bills, the vast majority were telling me absolutely not, oppose these bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of that went through the fact that so many people feel like our state has gone as far as our Constitution will allow.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, as we are trying to move these bills forward, really all we're doing is wasting taxpayer dollars by defending them in court. Mm-hmm. We know that they're going to be found unconstitutional.
Sure.
So why, you know, why would we do that? But also, when there are no provisions for families like yours,
mm-hmm.
that's just something that a lot of people, you know, cannot get behind. And I want to commend you and your wife for the bravery that you have shown in sharing, you know, what happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's really good for people to be able to put, you know, a real family's face on an issue that is really black and white in their mind. And it's not really personal to them. And, mm-hmm. I know that it's an issue that you're very unlikely to change a lot of people's minds about, but I think people need to hear stories like yours. And so I was really, I was really relieved that my constituents gave me such a clear-cut vote on mm-hmm. those.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for that. And again, thank you so much for your votes on these bills. I wish there were more people like you who were willing to stand on the principles about this issue. All right, well, you joined the legislature with 13 other first-year Democrats. Tell us a little bit about the class. It seems, at least from the outside, like you guys have a good amount of camaraderie.
Oh my gosh, I love these people. It's really hard. A common question that I get all the time is, oh, how are you enjoying it? Well, you know, it's tough when you're in the minority, but at least being with these people, you know, all of this new class and the senior people were just very welcoming to us, and the people in the House Democratic Caucus, you know, have just already become like family. If you're with these people, it's like going to war. and so these people, I mean, they're just great. They're all just such good people with really great hearts, and so many of them are there for all of the right reasons. And it's been tremendous. You know, we all got in this to serve our community, but we have gained a lot of friendships because of it. So
yeah,
it was a great plus.
That's great. Yeah, the Democratic caucus may be smaller than it has been in the past, but it seems like it's a lot more tight-knit, and it seems like the people like each other a lot. So that's always good.
Yeah, it is.
So we've been asking everybody this question. Do you have any favorites running for election during the statewide races for governor and other offices this May?
Well, I have made the decision to completely stay out of the primary. as someone brand new to politics and, you know, just first came out of my first session, and I really, part of that is just very selfish, you know. I'm tired. I want to take a little time for my family, and I don't really want to dive right back into the campaigns. Whoever comes out of the primaries, I absolutely will get behind. I will work as hard as I possibly can for the Democrats that are on this ticket, and I'm really looking forward to see what happens. I think there are several toss-ups, honestly, in the primary.
Yeah,
so
we'll
see.
I'm
really anxious to see what happens.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, at least you were straightforward and said you're not going to tell us. There are some people who are like, I like everybody. So that's good. We do appreciate that. Jasmine and I are grading everybody on their veracity in answering that question. Well, anyways, thank you so much for joining us, Representative Stevenson. We really appreciate it.
Of course. Anytime. I'm always happy to be here.
Okay, thank you guys. Thank you to Tish. Thank you to Sherilyn Stevenson for being on the show today. If you guys are interested, you can find our podcast at the podcasting app of your choice. We have a newsletter that you can subscribe to at forwardky.com/newsletters. If you want to support us, we have a Patreon. If you go to Patreon and search for My Old Kentucky Podcast, you can find it there. And I think that's all we say. Jasmine is usually the person that does the outro, as you're probably aware, and I hope I'm not missing anything. Anyways, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.